Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Mary Goldberg, award-winning, international, top innovating ICT serial entrepreneur. Mary, you have this incredible background, and I really appreciate you coming in today to share your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen. I've been looking forward to this. I appreciate the invitation.
Now, Mary, you've got this great background in academia, so can you share your time at UBC and some memorable lessons learned that continue to shape your outlook today?
Yes, absolutely. I loved UBC, and I continue to love UBC, and UBC has been really very instrumental in my professional career and, honestly, in my happiness as a person. I mean, the thing I think I loved most about UBC that I found very quickly when I came there as a graduate student, in fact, I was an undergraduate student for 1 year before I ended up as a graduate student there, is I really loved being around bright and often eccentric people because they were challenging. I mean, they were very interesting people. They all loved what they were doing, and they were working on something that obviously interested them. And as I say, when you interacted with these people, they didn't let you get away with anything. And so I think it helped me be better at what I do, and certainly was very entertaining and supportive kind of culture. And I really came to love universities in general, really because I think universities are one of the most noble pursuits in some ways of humanity. They really show the best side of humanity, pardon me, because they foster innovation and you know, it's their intent to expand knowledge and share knowledge and improve life in every way. So UBC in particular for me has been wonderful, and universities in general for me, and I've been very fortunate to visit many of them now. I have a high affinity for. I was there as a grad student, and I started as a TA, and I remember, I can't remember what year it was, I think it was probably late 80s, my then supervisor, who was Gerald Neufeld, a fantastic guy, suggested that I teach a course, and so I did, and I had no idea that I would ever be interested in teaching, but the moment I started teaching, I found that it was an amazing passion of mine, and UBC gave me that opportunity. I remember standing at the front of the class. One day, I think I was giving an exam, and I couldn't believe that they would actually pay me to do this. I mean, that's how much fun I had teaching. And then a little bit later on at UBC, Maria Clave came, and I know you know Maria Clave. She's an amazing person. So she came on as the head of the department while I was the chair of the Computer Science Graduate Students Association. And Maria has been also very important in my life, and UBC has kind of provided Maria to me in that sense, because she came on while I was there as a graduate student. Because Maria, I mean, everywhere Maria goes in life, she is a mentor and she's a supporter of people. She provides opportunities to people, and Maria was very much that, all of that for me. And one of the things that she did at UBC was she really placed an emphasis that hadn't been there before in the computer science department on teaching and the importance of teaching and excellence in teaching. I mean, UBC was already a good research institution, although she certainly doubled that in computer science, but teaching was a big focus of hers as well. So I had been teaching, and I loved teaching, and she created a couple faculty positions that were a little bit reversed when compared to the existing faculty positions that were there in computer science, whereas the focus on the existing faculty positions was primarily research, maybe say 80% and 20% teaching. These new positions that she had created were backwards in that sense. They were maybe 20% focused on research, but 80% focused on teaching. And so she suggested that I apply for one of those, and I got it. So I ended up being a faculty member at UBC. And that was, I had only, I think by that time, finished my master's, and really the intent for me in doing a PhD was to become a faculty member. So that kind of short-circuited that for me. And so I ended up being a faculty member now, I think it was about the late 90s. And I love teaching, and I really plan to do that for the rest of my life. And so while I was there in the early 90s teaching away, the web was gaining in popularity. And I was already using some basic kinds of technologies in my teaching. Simple things like listservs and email and those kinds of things. So I decided to do some research on the effectiveness of the web as a learning resource. Just the fact that I could do that, I think, and that UBC provided me that opportunity was wonderful. I mean, I have to say, for anybody considering what they want to do in their career, there's no better job in the world, as far as I'm concerned, than being a faculty member at a university. I highly recommend it, because what other location can you do exactly what it is that you want, supplied with resources, typically. You have no boss, more or less, and as long as what you're doing is worthwhile, is seen as worthwhile, and has some degree of success, everybody kind of leaves you alone. And that was, for me, what UBC was. And it allowed me to, as I say, do this research. And all of this eventually led to my work with WebCT, which pulled me out of the university.
You know, it's interesting you talk about UBC and also Maria Clave. And do you have any current interaction with Maria right now at Harvey Mudd?
Yes. In fact, I was just a couple of weeks ago. So let me just back this up a little bit. I've kept in touch off and on with Maria really the whole time since I was at UBC, and I've certainly followed what she's been doing, through Princeton and everywhere else she's been, now to Harvey Mudd. And again, she continues to do and will continue to do, no doubt, amazing things wherever she goes. But most recently, my interaction with Maria was just fantastic. I happened to be visiting her. We spend as much time as possible in the summer on a boat that we have with my family, and Maria spends time near where we are in their cabin, her and Nick's cabin on Pender Island. So last summer, I knew that she was around, and in fact we got connected because I wrote a blog, this maritime learning blog, and I happened to mention Maria as a phenomenal mentor, because I was doing some work with mentoring in the maritime industry. But anyway, so she got hold of that, she connected with me, she was on Pender, so I went and visited her, and we were talking a little bit about Harvey Mudd. And so what she had done was she invited me at that time to get to know Harvey Mudd a little bit more, with the hope that eventually maybe we could work together in some capacity. I don't mean me move there or anything like that, but work together in some capacity to reconnect and with her work at Mudd there. And so she invited me to come and give a talk at the Board of Trustees retreat, which happened just a couple weeks ago. And it was a fascinating group of people. I have to say, Harvey Mudd College, I knew a little bit about previously, but after meeting the people that are involved there, and in typical Maria style, the retreat included a good sampling of students from Harvey Mudd, amazing kids, and Mudd's providing them with just wonderful opportunities, I have to say. And that, of course, now has led to something else, because Maria's invited me to participate in this very interesting kind of think tank on the future of K-12 math education in the U.S. So I'd mentioned before, so I'm glad you asked that question, because I'd mentioned before that Maria is just that kind of person that supports and creates opportunities, and she's just not stopping doing that. It's wonderful to know Maria.
That think tank program that Maria is involved with, I think you're talking about the one with the Annenberg Foundation, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, it's interesting work, and sounds like it could have a major impact in education. So it'd be fascinating to follow the outcomes of that research and the work that's going to be done.
Well, I agree, and so it's a little bit intimidating, but I'm really looking forward to doing whatever I can to help out. But it's, again, no surprise that Maria's front and center in that. The world needs a lot more Marias.
Now, earlier in your discussion about UBC, you also talked about your research kind of leading to this idea of WebCT. Now, can you get into more detail about that, about this WebCT program? It was a world-leading sort of success associated with that. Can you provide an overview?
Yes, absolutely. You're correct. It really started with some of the research that I was doing there. So as I was mentioning, it was back in the early 90s, I guess it was, where I started. UBC provided me really an opportunity to, as I say, do whatever I wanted in some respect, as long as it seemed important. What I wanted to do then was look at the web and look at its potential in terms of learning effectiveness, in terms of student experience, to help the learning, help learning outcomes, basically. So its applicability to learning. So what I did with the help of the Center for Applied Studies and Evaluation at UBC, because computer scientists aren't that good at making experiments, so they helped design an experiment whereby I took an existing course that I was teaching, and it was a third-year computer science course teaching the implementation of operating systems. And I took that course and I divided the next offering of it into three groups. The three groups were, one was a web-only group, so one group of students took the course entirely online, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what that meant in a second. The second group of students took the course in the traditional way, that is face-to-face with me standing up at the front of the class and lecturing. And then the third group took the course combined, so they had full access to the web-based resources, and they had full access to the lectures. Now, what were the web-based resources? Now, remember back then, there almost was no such thing as e-learning. I mean, that's not entirely true in the sense that there was CD-based learning and you know, but web-based learning really didn't exist very much back then. But what we did was I actually hired I got a grant, by the way, a wonderful grant from UBC. Again, this is a great UBC thing. They have something which still exists today called the Teaching and Learning Enhancement Fund. And it's a multi-million dollar grant, not to one person, but they split it across many, many projects, I think in up to $50,000 increments. So anyway, I applied for and received a grant to do this bit of experimentation. So with that money, I hired some undergraduate students, and we took the course that I was teaching and put it online. And that meant, of course, putting the content online, but it also meant adding some interactive exercises, doing a little bit of online testing, doing things like a discussion area. I mean, the discussion area by itself was a really interesting thing. But basically, what you would see today in you know, your standard implementation of learning management systems, we built these little tools from scratch in a one-off course. So we conducted the experiment. We looked at it in two ways. We looked at both, as I had mentioned before, learning outcomes as best we could, and we looked at the student experience. And it was very interesting because it surprised me a lot, to be perfectly honest. I mean, first of all, walking into that experiment, my presumption was there was no possible way that students could learn as well without me standing in front of them lecturing to them. Fairly arrogant. I don't know why I felt that at the time. It certainly hasn't been the case, but that's what I assumed. And I thought maybe, you know, in the combined mode, they'd do a little bit better. What ended up being the case in terms of learning outcomes was that the web-based students performed equally well, if not even a little bit better, than the lecture-only students. And the most interesting part was that the combined students, that is the students who had access both to the lectures and the web-based resources, did much better, significantly better, than either of the other two groups. So this was some of the earliest research on the idea of, you know, web-based learning versus lectures and, most importantly, blended learning. And so we were kind of on to something. I should say a couple things about it, because I learned a lot from that set of experimentation. One thing was I learned also that the web-based students were a lot happier than the lecture-based students. Now, that's not always the case, although typically, I mean, there are a lot of advantages in just in terms of access and convenience and all these kinds of things which tend to make students better. I think in this case, though, one of the things that skewed the results a little bit was that the lecture-based students heard there was this, you know, obviously interacted with some of the web-based students, and they thought it was fascinating, and they were a little unhappy they were stuck in the old mode of the course. But regardless, the outcomes were very surprising for me in the sense that they were surprisingly positive. One of the interesting things, I mean, in this kind of one-off course that I talked about that we built online, one of the things that we built was a discussion area. And my brilliant idea for the reason that we needed a discussion area was that I thought, well, you know, like any faculty member, I get asked the same question over and over and over again. Wouldn't it be wonderful for me if the students could ask a question and it would be in a public forum, and then when I responded to the question, I could do so once because my wisdom would be immortalized for everybody to see from then on. And then if when the next 30 students ask the same question, I could just point them back at the bulletin board. So that was my great idea for why we needed a bulletin board. Well, so we implemented the bulletin board in this experiment, and it turned out that that was kind of a small benefit for me. But of course, what really happened was something completely different. And it was like, oh, that's interesting, until I realized the significance of it. And what it was when a student asked a question, often before I was able to get to the bulletin board to make a response, another student would respond. And then a third student would come in and say, no, I think that's not right. I think it's something else. It's like this. And then a fourth student would come in and a fifth student would come in. And so now, all of a sudden, we would get these amazingly beautiful discussions from, you know, peer to peer, student to student, that grew out of the ground and flowered, that simply did not exist before. I mean, you know, in the kinds of classes that I taught, we're talking 150, 200, 250 students, there is no venue for completely inclusive discussions. I mean, there are student study groups where 5 or 10 students might get together, or there is some opportunity for discussion in class, very little. But what this provided was a whole new thing, basically, where everybody who wanted to could discuss the topic at hand, which happened to be the assignment or the thing we were discussing in class that day or whatever. And so over the course of a 3-month course, we would end up with thousands and thousands of discussion posts in the bulletin board about this course. And it was fantastic. And so one of the experiments that we did, because we did several rounds of experiments, we asked the students, in fact, you know, are you comfortable making a contribution to a lecture-based discussion? So sitting in class and putting up your hand and saying something in class. And something like 50% of the students said, yeah, I'm comfortable doing that. Now, I thought that was high, because although we do have a lot of interactivity typically in my classes, I would say that fewer than 50% throughout the year say anything. But 50% said they were comfortable. Then we asked the same question, how many of you are comfortable making a contribution to a web-based discussion? And 70% of the students said they were comfortable doing that. And you can imagine why, right? Because, you know, putting your hand up in class, you put your hand up, the teacher points at you, you panic, you open your mouth, something comes out, it may not be what you intended, it's too late to take it back, you know, so, you know, that intimidates students, especially in large classes. Online, of course, if you have something to say, you can write it out, you can proofread it, you can have a buddy vet it, you can spell check it, all these kinds of things before it goes out, so you have a higher degree of confidence that it's not going to completely embarrass you. So 70% versus 50%. So that was nice. But then I dissected the numbers a little bit, and what I found was that if you took the union of the two groups, if you looked at the number of students, the percentage of students who are comfortable making a contribution to at least one of a web-based discussion or a lecture-based discussion, the number was about 90%. So what that meant was taking an existing class and adding to it a web-based discussion forum increased inclusivity from something like 50 to 90% in discussion. And to me, that was, oh, that's very interesting. And you know, to me, really, all these things that have happened in e-learning, most of them are, well, I was going to say most of them pale with compared to this effect, but I think the right way to say it is most of them revolve around this effect, actually, putting students together, putting, you know, enabling a more informal and peer learning model, and I mean, there's lots we could say about that, but it's one of the huge and most significant benefits of e-learning. So anyway, I can talk more about that if you want to hear more about it, but that was what grabbed me, and I just wanted to kind of reflect a little bit on what grabbed me in this whole e-learning thing. So we knew we were kind of onto something, so I applied for a second grant the next year to expand the experimentation. And just after we got the grant, before I put any of it to work, I thought to myself, you know, there must be a better way, because that first round of experimentation, it took a year. I hired, I think it was either 3 or 4 undergraduate students to build that course. So, you know, it was a $50,000 course that we had built, basically. And it required a lot of time. It was almost a year. It required a lot of technical expertise. These were computer science students. And it required a lot of money to do that. And I thought, well, you know, we're onto something here, and I really want to expand the experimentation that we're doing. And doing it, you know, at $50,000 one-off intervals wasn't probably the best way to do that. So I thought, what we'll do instead, and I checked with the granting people, I said, I want to shift this a little bit. What I'd like to do instead is build ourselves a set of tools that would allow us to more easily build these web-based courses. And then I believed that within that grant that we have, we could not only build the tools, but we, in fact, could take those tools and build 2 or 3 courses. So instead of having one course at the end of this, we would end up with 2 or 3 courses with which we could experiment and a set of tools with which we could continue the experimentation later. And they were all over it, so that was great. So we went ahead and do that. We built these tools. They ended up being called WebCT for Web Course Tools. And I was at a conference in early 1996. It was the WWW5, the 5th International World Wide Web Conference. And I was presenting the results of the experimentation that we did. And people were, you know, quite positive and very supportive of the experiment and the outcomes, because people were starting to, you know, care a little bit about web-based education. But at the end of the presentation that I was making, I had mentioned, and just in the conclusion, that, by the way, in order to do all this, we built these tools called WebCT. And I just provided a 2-minute explanation of them. Well, now people were suddenly very interested. And as soon as I stopped talking, I had a crowd around me of probably 10 or 15 people, you know, tell us about these tools. Can we use these tools? So within 6 months after that presentation in Paris, I had about 75 universities, really 75 individuals for the most part at each at their own university, who were using WebCT, because I was happily giving it away for free, and who were using it to build web-based courses, not primarily for experimentation purposes, but for delivery. And so that was very interesting, and the use of it was growing very, very quickly, but again, they were all free users. And it became very clear to me that, you know, my job as a faculty member at UBC was kind of being partially supplanted by my job as support person for all these people around the world who were using these tools that I was making. So my old supervisor, who I'd mentioned before, Gerald Neufeld, fantastic guy, suggested that I talk with a group at UBC called the University Industry Liaison Office, or UILO. And it's really their job to take technologies that are, or anything really, anything of value that's generated at the university, and if there is a will, to have that benefit society in one way or another. I should mention a little bit about UILO, because they were very ahead of their time at UBC. I can't tell you how many places I went around the world, because I traveled so much as WebCT got popular. I mean, I would do 200,000 plus qualifying miles a year. I figure I've given, just in the space of 2 to 3 years, 250 keynotes and invited presentations. But anyway, I can't tell you the number of people that said to me, if what you did had been invented at our university, it never would have seen the light of day outside of our academic walls. And it's really UILO at UBC that allowed that to happen. And I think that's critical, and it's a really important part of universities. Anyway, so the industry liaison office said, okay, yeah, you have something interesting here, maybe. Who knows? They didn't really necessarily get the significance of it. Neither did I, of course, at the time. And they said, we'll help you sell it to somebody, a publisher or somebody who can, you know, support these people and all that kind of thing. And by the way, incidentally, at UBC, for things like technology that are invented, UBC owned it. So I didn't own this, right? UBC owned it. And in fact, the first thing I had to do when I talked to UBC was sign something saying that I acknowledged that they owned it. But that was fine with me. I mean, as I say, it's the best job in the world. I'm just happy to keep doing it. So anyway, UILO found a publisher who was willing to pay, I think it was $30,000 at the time, for the rights to WebCT. And for me, I thought this was great, because UILO was going to give me half of that money to continue my research. I thought, well, $15,000, that's pretty good. We can have some fun with that for sure. And so that was going to happen. But what ended up happening was, over the next few months before that deal actually ended up taking place, and I didn't know this until the end, I guess the Canadian arm of the publisher and the U.S. arm of the publisher were fighting about something and finally couldn't reach agreement. So at the 11th hour, I got a call from the fellow who was at the publisher here in Canada, and he said, you know, I'm sorry, Murray, this deal's not going to happen. We thought it was, but there's all this internal stuff that's going on, and it's just not going to happen. So now, of course, we had far more people using WebCT, and we were getting to kind of this critical stage where we really couldn't support them anymore. I couldn't support them anymore, and we had to do something. And so I couldn't afford another 2, 3, 4 month negotiation with publishers, and UILO didn't have anybody kind of on the horizon to sell it to. So I said, look, how about if I just, in my spare time, I'll support these people. I'll hire some part-time undergraduate students to support these people. So I'll set up the business. And UILO again said, fine. And so what they did, the way those work at UILO at UBC is they take a small percentage of royalties of every sale that the company was to make, and they take a small ownership stake in the company as well, both small enough that it didn't impact in any negative way our ability to do business. And then so we did that. We started supporting these people. And I grossly underestimated the rate at which we were to grow. We were up to something like 50 employees in no time. We had 2 million students using the software at about 1,000 universities. And so this was not a part-time job. That most certainly was the case. So I took a leave from UBC. Another amazingly good reason to work at a university like this. It ended up being the case that WebCT grew so quickly that I could not possibly manage it in my spare time anymore with the employees that I had. So I had to take leave from UBC. And again, this is another amazingly wonderful reason to work at a university. They recognize that sometimes it's important for people that work there to go and do other things. So unlike a normal job that most less fortunate humans have, where I would have to quit and go away and take a fairly big risk, at UBC I could take leave. So I could ask for a year leave. My job would still be waiting for me when I got back, and I could go and do this thing, support these users of WebCT. And if it didn't work out, no problem. As I say, my job would be there for me. So I took a year leave. 1 year ended up turning into 2 years leave, which they were typically happy to also allow. I ended up asking for a third year leave because things were just growing and growing and growing, which they're not typically happy to allow, but they were very kind to me at the time and did allow it. And after 3 years leave, things were still growing and growing, so I finally had to give up my full-time faculty position at UBC, which I loathed to do because, it was what I expected to be doing for the rest of my life, but WebCT just needed me. I don't need anybody to feel sorry for me because I really loved running this company. I mean, honestly, partly because it was successful, and there's nothing like having a success and being an e-learning celebrity, which I don't want to label myself as, but it's kind of funny and interesting when you're at an e-learning conference and somebody asks you for your signature. It's just kind of weird, to be perfectly honest. But you know, this is a new thing, and I think it kind of speaks to the community that was there. And I used to refer to this community, this group of people who cared about e-learning, as the smallest, most supportive, collegial group of millions of people that you'd ever meet. And because that's what it was. It was millions of people that cared about this, but it felt like it was the tiniest little community. I mean, we interacted by email. We had a WebCT user group, you know, that received 50 to 100 messages a day, and people were just excited about this. It was a time of remarkable change and promise. Really, if we all felt we were doing something tremendously important, and everybody was excited to be a part of it. I remember. I hope I'm not getting too far off topic here, but I remember when we actually went live in 1997. And by live, what I mean is we transitioned from a free software to something that we actually asked people to pay for, so that we could support them. We were to go live September 1st, 1997. Of course, we planned for it well in advance, and we told people what was happening and whatnot. But as part of our typical release of beta versions of the software, we would put these little time limitations in the software to make sure that people couldn't continue to use the beta forever, because we wanted to clear betas out and all their bugs. We needed them to upgrade. So anyway, on September 1st, 1997, after, you know, however many institutions, you know, 700 or whatever it was, sent us checks to use WebCT, to continue using WebCT, well, worldwide, at midnight, as the clock struck midnight in the various time zones in the world, WebCT stopped working for every user in the world. And so I got a call. I think it hit Australia first. We found out. Got a call from Sassam Salari, who was my partner on all this. He was originally a student of mine and ended up being really a partner in WebCT. Fantastic guy also. And he said, "Murray, we have a problem. WebCT is worldwide now stopped working. You know, millions of students depending on this." And I thought, well, you know, darn, we're dead. We're basically dead. And so Sassen and I, with some of the other developers, worked through the night to make a patch. I emailed everybody en masse with the patch. to let them know what they had to do to make it work again. And then, you know, by this time it was maybe 5 a.m., 6 a.m., and I thought, okay, well, you know, hopefully nobody's going to come and kill me, but whatever happens, we don't have a company anymore, that's for sure. So then the emails started to roll in. And they were all, of course, in response to the message that I sent out, which was subjected something like, we have a bit of a problem. So all these emails started coming back to me, you know, we have a bit of a problem. And as I started flipping through these, I think there were well over 100 that day. 99, let's say there were 100, 99 of them all said, you guys are fantastic. I can't believe how quickly you solved this problem. If this was some other large unnamed software company, they would have charged us for this patch. You reacted so quickly. You know, they were being nice to us. We screwed up royally. We made their lives miserable. And keeping in mind, you know, these people, they all had their necks out, right? Because they were implementing something new on campus, which was not proven. I mean, the whole idea was not proven. E-learning then was not like e-learning now. It was a very different environment. There were a lot of skeptics. Let me tell you, I happily tell you more about that. But anyway, except for one person who was mildly annoyed, every single other one was appreciative, kind, understanding, and thankful. And I thought, wow, this is a group of people I want to work with for the rest of my life. And that's exactly, it was just such a phenomenal community to be a part of. So I loved working at WebCT. I really did. So anyway, fast forward a little bit to 1999, and the company was still growing like crazy. And up until just a little time before that, we were kind of the only ones around. You know, we had something like 80% of the market as it existed at that time. But I think because of our success, e-learning was now on the radar of people like investors, people certainly at other universities, other entrepreneurs who wanted to go down this road, because it kind of showed that, well, you know, there's something here. It isn't just something that's going to go away as many people predicted. So what we saw, you know, I said this was early 1999, we saw it in advance of this, we saw a lot of really well-funded and well-organized competition started springing about. And, you know, these are people who had millions of dollars to compete against us. And now, me as just a fairly naive Canadian guy who had no business experience, we weren't charging very much for WebCT. I mean, I think our largest license at the time was $3,000 a year, because I calculated that that's about what we need to continue to develop the software, you know, with a reasonable staff and to support our users in a reasonable way. So we were charging very little. We never had a single salesperson, up till that time, up till, early 1999, not one. So we were operating for, 2 years commercially and really 3 years in total, and we didn't have not one salesperson, yet we were growing like crazy people. But we realized that the writing was on the wall here, right? Because our competitors did have salespeople. Our competitors had large advertising campaigns. They were conferences now, they started sending people to gain business. And it was a little bit scary. And I knew that we had this great lead in the market, so that we had to kind of do something about that. So we had a choice. We could either invest. And I didn't have the money, so we could either get people to invest for us, so that we could hire the right kinds of people and grow that way, or we could sell to somebody who had money and knew what they were doing. And so an opportunity presented to sell not all of the company, but most of the company to a competitor called ULT, who were based in Boston. They were very, very well-funded. They had great expertise. They had a product, a competing product, that they couldn't sell to anybody, mostly because we had most of the market and everybody was quite happy with us at the time. But we did sell. We combined the companies and we ballooned very quickly from, I can't remember if we had maybe 60 or 70 employees at that time, to within a year, I'd say about 350 employees. So we grew to try to meet this competition head on. And things were still developing at an amazing pace, not just commercially, but right around that same time, because there were really no conferences specifically about e-learning, we decided to hold our first WebCT user conference. And This was a very scary idea because I thought, you know, there's no precedent for this. This is going to be incredibly embarrassing if I put out the call for papers and get a few papers submitted, select a few, and then open up registration and 10 people come. I mean, that would be horrible. I thought at least if we have 50 people come, then we can have a nice little conference. Well, a month before registration was to close, we had over 700 registered to come to Vancouver. And this was our first meeting of this amazing group I'd mentioned before of millions of people around the world who were just, you know, so eager to share and to expand the knowledge in e-learning. And we had the best conference in the world. So as I say, you know, this was a time of tremendous change, both in terms of the community supporting e-learning and in terms of the company, in terms of the software. It was just phenomenal and wonderful to be a part of.
So you have this situation where you've sold the company, or really a good portion of, you've grown like crazy, you hold your first conference, and what happens after that? I mean, you're not really affiliated with that group anymore, are you?
Yeah, it was very interesting because what happened after that was I agreed to stay on a minimum of 3 years. I was very strongly identified as Mr. Web CT, for better or for worse, and it was an affiliation and an identification that I cherished. I mean, I liked, and I think it grew because I really did connect personally with every customer we had, not because I thought for whatever reason it was a good business idea. I didn't have any good business ideas, but because I tremendously enjoyed connecting with these people. They were wonderful people. And for those reasons and others, I was still identified as Mr. Web CT. But as I say, I agreed to stay on for 3 years. And over that time, what happened was, I, of course, had less and less of a role in the direction of WebCT, but I was still viewed externally as the person who was in charge, which really wasn't the case anymore. Now, don't get me wrong, I have not a single regret. For me personally, I know I did exactly the right thing at the right time. I can only hope that for the industry and for the company, I did the right thing at the right time. That's for others to judge. But I really did expect this kind of transition over the 3 years, but I found that in the end, 3 years was a little bit too long. By the end of the 3 years, I had other ideas for businesses I wanted to do. I actually ended up transitioning into a company that I co-founded, in fact, with Maria Clave and a few others called Silicon Shock. But that 3 year time was a little bit too long. As I continued to give up responsibility, but not externally in the eyes of our customers, give up responsibility. So it ended up being, I was happy to leave at the end of that time, let's just say.
It's interesting, you know, when you're talking about this whole development of e-learning, and a bunch of words came into mind, and maybe you can comment on some of these words, and I'm just going to throw them out. And CBT Systems, SmartForce, Skillsoft, Coursera, Udacity, Audacity, MOOCs, Athabasca University, and Commonwealth of Learning. And you can choose which ones you want to comment on.
Holy cow. Okay, that's a smorgasbord of a lot of really important words. So I'll play the word association game, and I'll see what I can do here. Number one, the first thing that came to mind as you started talking about these is the division between corporate training and higher ed e-learning. These grew as two almost disjoint branches out of the same kind of set of roots, I guess, or the same trunk. And it was very interesting to watch that happen because, in fact, before we ended up combining in 99 with ULT, which retook the name WebCT, we were actually offered to be purchased by Asymmetrics. I don't know if you remember, it was a Paul Allen company out of Seattle. And now Asymmetrics wasn't really doing higher ed stuff. They were primarily doing corporate e-learning, corporate training. And I don't think the corporate training market was at that time quite as well defined, in the sense that there were a lot of players in the corporate training market. It was much more concentrated on WebCT and one or two competitors in the higher ed market. But anyway, we didn't end up doing that for a number of reasons, but one of the main ones was it became very, very clear that these were really two separate markets, and by and large have remained two very separate markets, which to many people is kind of a surprise, because you would think, well, you know, training is learning, learning is training. Really, is there that much difference? Why is it the case that pieces of software rarely cross over? I mean, with WebCT, we had less than 10% of our users outside of higher education, and that included some in K-12. But anyway, it is the case that really just the organization and the structure and whatnot of training in the corporate world is quite a bit different than it is in higher ed. So I'm glad you kind of mentioned some of those, because it's actually a fairly interesting area, at least to me. I hope it is to others as well. You also mentioned a lot of really interesting new things that are out there now. MOOCs and Udacity and all these kinds of things. You know, it's fascinating to see how things change. I mean, MOOCs started really as a very kind of peer-to-peer, and people will get mad at me when I say this, but almost chaotic way of learning where, you know, curriculum is created by the learning community in some sense, and assessment may or may not be part of it. And I think that term has almost kind of been co-opted for this for this somewhat different rather approach, which is really, it's still massive and it's still online, obviously, but it's in some sense instructor-less in the sense that you don't have real interactions with your instructor, because, you know, if I'm teaching 10,000 people, obviously I can't have personal interactions with each of my students. Instead, I have recorded lectures or whatever it is that go out. And to me, again, these things are fascinating. And I talked about before what I love about universities and how they represent the best of humankind in disseminating knowledge and creating knowledge. And MOOCs are a big part of this, or can be a big part of this, right? And I think people are fascinated by MOOCs now, simply because of the fact that they have the opportunity to educate those who otherwise would not have the opportunity. I don't think anybody's pretending necessarily that they will provide a better education, or maybe even not as good an education as the kinds that we can do in more personalized environments. But they can provide an education, and where the alternative is none, well, guaranteed that's a huge benefit, right? So it's a very interesting to watch these, and there's lots of issues surrounding them. It's, you know, I was having some great conversations about Udacity, for example, and you know, it's a great company that's making, you know, software to make MOOCs a reality. Although most large e-learning systems, most large learning management systems are now kind of moving in the same regard. But there's this whole idea now about, you know, who's the provider and who's, you know, how are these branded? Are these Udacity courses or are these Stanford courses? I think there's a lot of tension now in the sense that, you know, universities don't want to kind of, in some sense, repeat the whole academic publishing mode where the publisher is front and center and the universities are free content providers to that business, basically. Instead, make it so that the content provider, in this case, I'll use Stanford again as the example of the university supplying the professor to teach this these large MOOCs, is much more front and center, and it's a Stanford course as opposed to a Udacity course. So there's so many little issues going on now, and it's going to take a long time to get them sorted out and to see where everything lands. Just like, you know, the whole e-learning thing did 15 years ago, and when people were predicting its demise in a very short time. For sure, every single word that you mentioned really, I think, underscores how much has changed in such a short amount of time. There is not a day that I wake up now and I'm not in awe of both the scope and the depth and the speed of change that has happened in higher education. I mean, really, for 2,000 years or more, learning was more or less static in the sense that we did it exactly the same way. Well, you know, in the last 15 years, it's really been turned on its head, and it's continued to be turned on its head over and over again, you know, during that 15 years. So it's, and every word, as I say, that you threw out really embodies these amazing changes. And that's why it's such a wonderful area to be working in.
You know, earlier in our discussion about sort of the history leading up to WebCT and your involvement with WebCT, you talked about web-based learning, some of the research in that area. Can you add some more to that idea about your research and the effectiveness of web-based learning?
Sure. So I talked a little bit about my own research, and I think, if you don't mind, I want to talk a little bit more broadly, because it was a very, we have a problem with respect to learning. And it's not a new problem. It's not a problem created by technology. It's a problem that's always existed. And the problem is, it's very hard to definitively say whether or not what we're doing is working, right? I mean, how can you measure whether or not people are learning? Now, I'm not saying we don't try. We do try, and we have our best facsimile for actually trying to measure this, but how can you do it? Because first you have to define what learning means in order to know, to be able to try to, you know, have any hope of measuring it, and people can't even agree on what learning means. And so it's very easy for me to say, yeah, well, we measured the academic effectiveness of the web as a tool for learning. Well, you know, anybody who knows anything about this area immediately goes, but just a second, you know. And so I'm glad you asked the question, because I really have to back up and talk about that a little bit. Now, back in the olden days of e-learning, as I say, mid-90s, let's just say, the prevailing assumption was the same one that I had before I did my level bits of experimentation, was that, you know, it can't possibly be as effective as what we're doing now. And, you know, there's a reason it's been the same for 2,000 years. It's because it works. And you can't, it's very hard to argue with that, especially because it's very difficult to actually measure these things. And so that's been one of the biggest sticking points in terms of widespread adoption, or it had been one of the biggest sticking points. I think that's changing to a very large degree now, because obviously my little bits of experimentation were only one kind of drop in the bucket compared to what's happened, you know, what was starting to happen then, and certainly what's happened since. Many far better equipped people have done similar measurements, and by and large come to the exact same conclusion, which is very gratifying. And in fact, I think it was 2010 or 2011, the U.S. Department of Education came out with a meta-analysis. They went and they looked at over 1,000 research reports, experiments like I had done, selected from those, I think, ultimately about 50 that they thought were rigorous enough and met the criteria of what they were trying to evaluate and whatnot. And they were trying to ask the simple question, what does the prevailing research, you know, what does this meta-analysis tell us about whether or not e-learning works? And their conclusion was exactly the same conclusion that I came to back in 1995 in my small sample case, which is that web-based learning is as effective as face-to-face lectures, by and large. In fact, if you combine the modes, you get a higher degree of effect. And so this is, as I say, looking at many, many different studies, each with their own way of trying to, you know, what is learning and assess whether or not it works and whatnot. And so I think, fortunately, we've come to the point now where anybody who bothers to take the time to actually, you know, read the prevailing wisdom as opposed to just go based on their gut, believes with good reason now that that web-based learning really is very effective. And so when you add to the knowledge that yes, it actually does work and it works just as well, now you can start talking about its other wonderful benefits that simply don't exist in kind of your lecture-based course, and you're not giving up effectiveness, you're not giving up student experience. And so some of the obvious things, like, you know, anywhere, anytime, and those kinds of things, but some of the much more, I think, well, no, they're not more important, sorry, some of the things that people don't think about as much, let me put it this way, such as being able to collect analytics that you couldn't hope to dream of being able to collect in a lecture-based environment that can support continuous improvement in the education process. You know, computers are great at producing reams and reams of data for you. So if you just have an idea of what you want your computer to tell you, if you know the question you want it to ask, it's happy to produce a large volume of data about that question. So if we want to ask our computer, how are our students using this piece of learning content? How are they performing on exams? You know, how are competencies tied between the questions that we're asking and the content we're providing them? You can get a lot of data on this. So if you ask the right questions, and then you have a way of interpreting the results, and both of those, by the way, are hard, but we're getting better and better at it, Now all of a sudden we have something that we couldn't have dreamt of having before. Real data on how people learn, and how we can improve how they learn. And that's why I think this is, I mean, nobody would disagree. I think that this is not our learning renaissance right now.
In the list of words that it sort of gave, where you provided some comment, I also talked about Athabasca University here in Canada and this thing called the Commonwealth of Learning, involving over 50 Commonwealth countries, and it's all about online learning. Are you involved in some way with the work that they do?
I'm not really involved with them. I mean, certainly I've interacted with many of the people at Athabasca in the Commonwealth, over the many years, but I don't have a real direct connection to them. But you know, I think that, you know, Athabasca did and continues to do a lot of really pioneering work in e-learning, and they have their focus very, you know, directly on the organizational view and the kind of the outcomes part of it. And so it's critical to have them, but I think they, and I think the Commonwealth of Learning, really underscore some of the great things that that this worldwide community can do, and how they can bring e-learning basically to the masses, how they can make it available to those that simply didn't have access to it before, and most importantly, in some ways, how we can really cooperate to learn from one another, to take the best practices from places like Athabasca, and to disseminate them and implement them worldwide in a, you know, very short order. And it's really these networks of people that allow this to happen.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about the effectiveness of web-based learning and some of your research with WebCT and so on, and then sort of the broader perspective. And you also talked about the fact that you're being asked to get involved with the work that Maria's working on with the Annenberg retreat at Sunnylands. And I know that Khan Academy is part of that, and Sam O'Khan is one of the people involved in that work with a bunch of other really well-known people. Is part of your participation going to be about your expertise in all of the web-based side of it?
I'm hoping I can't absolutely answer that question yet because I have yet to attend the first meeting, but I believe and would hope that the reason I have been asked to participate is just because of my background in e-learning. I mean, I don't have a background specifically in math education. I don't specifically have a background in K-12, which are the primary focal points of all this. But yes, I think now a discussion about learning, a discussion about improving education, can't almost be held without some discussion on how can technology help us achieve these things. And so I hope that's how I could contribute best to this discussion.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity with someone, Khan, there, involved in the Khan Academy, which is so successful, Maria, of course, and Bill and some of the other people from his the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and many other sort of people heavily into education. So it'd be interesting to see some of the outcomes as they go forward, and maybe we can even do an interview just talking about, you know, where you see that going perhaps in the future.
I'd love to do that. As long as I don't embarrass myself there, then I'd be more than happy to talk about it.
Okay, now what can you tell us about your current work?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I've been involved in e-learning forever. I hope to continue to be involved in it forever, as close to forever as I can. I mentioned Silicon Chalk, which is something that Marie and I did, which was fascinating. That was right after WebCT. And then after Silicon Chalk, I did that for about 4 years. It was fascinating work, actually. But after that time, I didn't know what to do. I wasn't sure if I wanted to start another company, if I wanted to go back and teach at the university. I remember sitting with my wife. My wife is first she's a mathematician, and she has a mathematics degree, and she has an architecture degree, so she was practiced as an architect for 10 years. But mostly now she paints. She's a wonderful and successful painter. Anyway, I was in her studio and contemplating what to do next. And I think the word retirement came out of my mouth, and she stopped what she was doing, turned around, and with a look that I can't possibly describe to you in a podcast, but I think you get it, said to me, "What are you going to do for the rest of your life? Sit there and watch me paint?" And so I knew that wasn't really an option. So I started doing some consulting, just kind of trying to think about what I want to do next. And I ended up getting involved with BC Ferries. Now, BC Ferries is one of the largest ferry operators in the world here, and I'm based in Vancouver, British Columbia, and they run 35 vessels, you know, millions of people a year. I can't remember all the statistics, but as I say, they're, depending on how you measure, the first or the second or the third largest ferry operator in the world. Anyway, they wanted to look at how they trained their, started with how they trained their captains, in fact. And I got connected with BC Ferries, and I was asked to participate in this effort. And it wasn't exactly the kind of thing that I normally do, but it seemed interesting to me, and it seemed like important work. So I thought, okay, yeah, and the people seemed very nice, and I thought I'd like to be a part of that. And so I did, and together we ended up creating a kind of a pilot program. No technology involvement at all. Just you know, how do you train people, and how do you measure outcomes, and how do you continuously improve, and all that kind of thing. Because the maritime industry is very interesting for a number of reasons, which I'll get into in a second. But, you know, they have deep and traditional training roots, and a lot of the, I mean, there's certification training, which happens in classrooms and stuff like that. But there's the other half of training that happens when somebody gets on board and needs to understand how do things work on this vessel, you know, and how can we be safest in this environment and all that kind of thing. So anyhow, traditionally that's done by saying, hey, Stephen, you follow around Joe for 2 weeks, and by the end of that, you'll probably get it, you know. And so, you know, not a super kind of organized, repeatable, standardized way of doing training. So they wanted to change that, and BC Ferries is really a leader in trying to improve safety and performance. So, as I say, we started a pilot, and it was very well received. It was limited to a small number of people, but it worked out really, really well. And in evaluating the pilot, BC Ferries ultimately came to the conclusion that, well, you know what? We don't want to just do this for our masters anymore. We want to do this company-wide for 4,500 operational employees. So, as soon as the numbers go from whatever it is, 100 or whatever, to 4,500, well, technology has to come into play, because you're going to need technology's help in one way or another. So I thought, hey, no problem. I'm your guy. You know, we'll scope out the best learning management system, and we'll get it implemented for you, and that's great. So I pretty quickly realized, though, why the maritime industry seems to be about 12 or 14 years behind in terms of using technology to help in training. And that's because their context is very, very different. I mean, think about BC Ferries. There's a couple things that happen, two major ones and a bunch of minor ones. The two major ones are that many of their vessels operate outside of connectivity range, right? I mean, you might, when you're close to shore, you might have a little bit of cell reception. You might have satellite if you're lucky, but it's expensive and slow and the latency is high. But mostly you're just simply disconnected while you're out at sea. Well, you want people to train. You don't want them to be away from their learning resources, basically. So traditional LMSs really can't help you there. The other thing, which is in some sense more technically problematic, really, although both are, is that if you're at BC Ferries, or really any maritime vessel operator, and you're going to be a deckhand, well, you know, it's not the case that a deckhand is a deckhand is a deckhand. I mean, if you're taking calculus, calculus is calculus, but not so with a deckhand, because if I want to be a deckhand operating on BC Ferries, well, the job routines, the equipment I have to understand, everything changes dramatically from one vessel to another. Vessels aren't standardized. Job routines on the vessels aren't standardized. So when I train to be a deckhand, I need to train to be a deckhand operating on the Spirit of British Columbia while it's running on Route 1 and with all the various equipment that's on that vessel and all that kind of thing. So what are they faced with? Well, job shadowing is kind of what they're faced with, because the alternative is producing as many as, well, you know, the cross product of the number of vessels times the number of routes times the number of job positions in terms of learning modules. Completely impossible, and that's why they don't have that. So what did we do? Well, we realized that no learning management system was going to provide access in a disconnected environment, nor be able to provide learning modules that were dynamically assembled according to the attributes of the learner, let's just say. And so we collectively decided, well, let's build one, because it doesn't exist. And so that's what we did. And so this is now the genesis of what I'm doing now. Sorry to take so long to get to answer your question, which is marine learning systems. So what we have is we've built a learning management system that's specifically built for the maritime training context, which happens to actually be a fairly large market, but also applies, we're finding, to other related or similar kind of contexts, like the oil and gas industry. Again, you can think of all these oil rigs out either at sea or on land, typically disconnected, sophisticated environments where, you know, being a roughneck on one is not the same as being a roughneck on the other. So what does our LMS do? You could probably guess just from what I've talked about. It will allow for what we call remote training appliances to exist on vessels, and those are effectively LMS servers which opportunistically synchronize to the authoritative land-based LMS server, so that as changes are made in the one location on land, a new course, say, is added during synchronization, that will be replicated out to the vessel-based servers. And likewise, when training and assessment and whatnot happens on the vessel-based servers during synchronization, all the learning logs and analytics all come back to the centralized authoritative server, so the training administrators can have access to all that. So that's one thing that it does. And the other thing that it does is it does dynamically assemble content. So we've taken technically a very simple database-driven approach, which really houses all of the various learning resources for every piece of equipment, you know, for every vessel and that and whatnot. We build the relationships in the database such that we know this this piece of equipment is on this vessel right now, all that kind of thing. And then we built a little language that allows us basically to combine all these things together. So now, when a deckhand walks up to the learning management system and says, I need to be a deckhand on the Spirit of BC on Route 1, the LMS reaches into the database, dynamically assembles all the bits of content that it needs to present to that learner to be a deckhand on that vessel on that route, and it combines it into an integrated, seamless, very cohesive package that looks as though it was built by hand for that person and that learning instance. And so there are a number of other things that we do as well, but those are kind of the that's the main technical thrust anyway of what we had to do to build something that was meaningful for the maritime industry. So now we're at the point where we've had this wonderful relationship with BC Ferries, and once again, I can't say enough positive things about BC Ferries. They're absolute leaders in the world, in the maritime industry, and they actually just recently won a lovely, prestigious corporate university exchange award about how they've applied technology to their learning process. Great, great organization. And on top of that, they're phenomenal business partners. They've been so good to work with because they're engaged, because they care, and because they've been really supportive of me and my company. And so just in the last little while, we've started making this LMS available to the maritime industry at large. We're building a new version right now, one that will be a little bit broader in terms of its applicability to different maritime learning contexts. And it's way too early to tell. I'm self-funding it. We're very small. There are six of us right now, and I'm super enjoying it. We have a lot of great interest. We have another customer that's signed on right now, much smaller than BC Ferries, but many, many, many who I think are poised, just waiting for our next release. So I'm having fun again.
And there's integration and mentoring in this in a formal way within the program?
Well, yes and no. It's interesting because my involvement with the maritime industry, it's not strictly business, I guess you could say. I mean, because I've had to learn so much over the last 5 years about how it works and whatnot, I've gained quite an affinity really for the people in it and for what they do and for how they do it. And one of the things that occurred to me pretty quickly is just as they have kind of deep and traditional training practices, they also view mentoring as a traditional and important practice, for sure. But in my involvement with them, it became clear that mentoring was becoming progressively more and more difficult in the maritime industry because crew sizes are shrinking, people are much more mobile than they used to be. So the kinds of mentoring relationships that used to happen on board were becoming more and more problematic because, as I say, smaller crews, people would leave, you know, just as you're getting going and whatnot, and, you know, this whole disconnected nature, all these kinds of things. And being a technologist and understanding social systems and social learning systems and that kind of thing, I thought, well, you know, it would take me nothing to basically set up an e-mentoring platform for the industry, not as part of a business, but just as something to, because I thought I could do and I thought would be easy for me, harder for most people in the maritime industry, but I thought dovetailed beautifully into their very strong traditional mentoring kind of background. And so I, on LinkedIn, I put out a message that basically said, hey, I'd be willing to do this. Would you guys be willing to be mentors? Because I'm not going to do this unless I know there, you know, are at least a few people out there who are willing to kind of seed the community as mentors. So kind of like my first conference, I expected, you know, if we have 5 or 10 people that say yes and they're half decent, you know, mentor material, that's great. It's worth it. I'll launch it. Well, 200 amazingly experienced maritime industry professionals and retired professionals, all the way from people working on the tugs on the lakes to ex-U.S. Navy atomic submarine captains, and I mean that, volunteered to be mentors. So 200 of them. So I thought, well, now I have a responsibility. And so that's what I did. I set up the site. It's 100% volunteer. Nobody makes any money on it. The mentors volunteer. The protégés don't pay. It's all free. And I just run it off of one of our servers. And I pay as much attention to it as I can because, you know, despite the inherent desire to mentor and whatnot, these communities take some effort to advertise, to get going, to seed, to you know, nurture, basically. And so I'm doing that as much as I can. And now I think we're approaching 350 or 400 members. The activity is just starting to pick up a little bit. So I'm writing articles on it and whatnot. So I'm a big believer in the potential of it. And I think just as time gets going, we're going to see a lot of great activity on it.
So now where do you see yourself in, let's say, 3 years?
That's a really good question. I mean, I can't imagine professionally doing anything other than e-learning. Not just because I love it, but because, you know, it's kind of important, I've always felt, to do what you know. And this is, if I know anything, I guess it's this. Again, others can be the judge of whether or not I actually know this, but there's nothing else that I know that I guess comes close to what I know about this. So I want to keep doing this. It's my intent to work for the rest of my life. And it's not just my wife staring at me and saying that I can't sit there and watch her paint. I love working. I would like to work a little bit less, but I love working. So it's my hope right now that this current company, Marine Learning Systems, finds enough success. It doesn't have to be big or anything, but finds enough success so that it continues to grow at whatever rate that it is, either slow or fast, but it continues to grow. And it's big enough that it can support a number of employees, including myself. And what I would like to be able to do is cut back and hire people who are better at doing some of the things that I'm doing right now, and then allow myself to work maybe half days so I can enjoy I'm not that old, although, again, depends on who you ask, but I turned 50, so I'm not ready to be put out to pasture at all yet. But I do want to have more time to spend with my life. I want to travel a little bit more. My kids are at the age where they're just, you know, grade 10 and grade 12, so they're looking at university and whatnot. And so I want the perfect life, I guess, as everybody does. And the perfect life for me is a combination of continuing to work forever, but also having time to enjoy my personal life.
So, Murray, we're going to take a little bit of a different shift in the questions now and you know, move to, let's say, the Manning Awards, which are involved with some of the general issues involving the industry and away from your specific WebCT company or the learning management system company that you're involved with. And so the first question is sort of the sort of more broader issues is, if you can share some of your insights and best practices that you've learned from your chairman role with the Manning Awards here in BC.
Yeah, the Manning Awards are very interesting. I suspect a lot of people don't know about them, and they should. So if you don't mind, I'll just tell you a little bit about them first. So the Manning Awards are a national Canadian award for innovation in any human endeavor. And so every year Well, actually, I want to tell you a little bit about their genesis as well. So about 30 years ago, David Mitchell, who was, I think, the chair of Alberta Energy at the time, a large oil company, which is now in Canada. I think it was called Alberta Energy. I might have that wrong. Anyway, an amazing person. I keep saying that about people, but I've had the fortune of meeting a lot of amazing people. He decided that, you know, as Canadians, we're far too humble, and really what we need to be able to do is foster a culture of innovation, especially in our young people, because that's really what drives society and drives change. And so he went to Sweden to look at how the Nobel Prize was run and brought that knowledge back and set up the Manning Awards really based on that model. So there are four main prizes given out every year. There's a $100,000, principal award, it's called. There is a $25,000 award and two $10,000 awards. And the two $10,000 awards are reserved for people who don't have the benefit or support of a research lab, either at a university or at a corporate research lab. And so you get this tremendous and very interesting breadth of innovations that are recognized every year. And in a temporary lapse of judgment in 2004, they gave me the principal award for my work in e-learning, but they've since rectified all the problems that led to that, and so they only award really meaningful projects now, or really meaningful innovations. And so now, 30 years after, there's this great breadth of innovations that have been recognized in Canada, and I think they're making a difference. Every year they have a gala for the awards. I attend them now. This year's was in Ottawa. There were probably 600 people there, all the various politicians and whatnot. And if you ever have a chance to go and attend, and you can, because they're open, these galas are open to the public, to go and attend one of these annual galas, they're amazing, because you hear from the winners, of course, which are great stories of innovation and perseverance and achievement, but you also hear from four young Canadians who have come up through the ranks of the science fairs and have been awarded with Young Canadian Manning Awards, and the work that these 15, 16, 17-year-olds are doing just boggles the mind. So they're very, very inspirational evenings. So anyhow, because I got involved in 2004, it's something very near and dear to my heart. To me, as I've expressed, I think, a couple times in this conversation, innovation, you know, the furthering of knowledge, all these kinds of things are core values of mine. And so when I was asked to be the chair of the BC chapter, I said yes, and so I have been now for a number of years. And it allows me, selfishly, it allows me to interact with a lot of fantastic people from BC, NSERC, IRAP, venture capitalists, I mean, really, really great people who are on my committee, who every year are charged with the task of bringing forward BC innovations to make sure they get nominated. And there's something in the water here in BC, because over the history of the Manning Awards, we're disproportionately successful in terms of winning the Manning Awards. So it's there's something going on here, but we seem to be doing something very good in terms of how we raise our innovators. So I love the Manning Awards. You know, your question was more about, you know, what has it taught me, and I think what it's allowed me to do, well, it's taught me two things. I mean, it's introduced me to more great people, such as David Mitchell, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, and now his son, who heads the awards, who really are givers, you know, and I look at these people, and I think it's something I would like to aspire more to be, people who are completely and selflessly giving of their time and their money and whatnot, to improve things. And that's what these people are doing with Manning Awards, and the whole story of the foundation of the awards and the creating of the awards by David Mitchell and his personal time and effort that he put into it, I think, is quite inspirational in that regard. But the other thing really is that it allows, for me, innovation to kind of remain front and center as much as possible in my life, and allows me to meet all these other innovators in BC, and I think it's just a great model with the goal of telling young Canadians, look, I mean, sure, you may want to be a rock star, you may want to be a hockey player, but you know what? it's also really cool to be an innovator and look at the great things that innovators do. And you can do this and, you know, come and hear their stories about how they managed to get to where they are now and how they went from an idea to something that benefits people around the world. And so the many awards have been an important part of my life. It's only something that I wish I had a little bit more time to give to, and if I achieve my goal of working a little bit less in the years to come, no time soon for sure, but in the years to come, then maybe I can give a little bit more in terms of time to the awards.
As you indicated, you're the chair of the BC chapter of the Manning Awards. And as chair, is there some specific call to action that you can make to the audience?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking, because I should have mentioned that. My call to action for the audience, if you're in Canada, then what you need to do is seek out innovators and seek out successful innovations. And if you're one of those people who have a successful innovation, you need to know about the Manning Awards and direct them to manningawards.ca, because we really do want to recognize you. And that's what it's about. It's about shining a spotlight on the great work that's happening in Canada. And so, you know, the call to action for the award specifically is, if you already are at the stage where you know of or are a successful innovator, then we need to know about you. We need to apply. And I guess the more foundational call to action is that innovation is something that is an amazing life choice, I guess you can say. And if you're the kind of person that, for whatever reason, values innovation, you should consider it as a career. The innovators that I have met, I mean, maybe it sounds funny to think about innovation as a career. I mean, you think of dentistry as a career or law as a career, but is innovation a career? And I would argue that it absolutely is, and it's something that you can aspire to, and it's something that you can achieve. And so whatever discipline that you are interested in, you can work in that discipline or you can innovate in that discipline. And what I would suggest to you is that it may be immensely satisfying to consider innovating in that discipline.
These next two questions are to provide sort of a broader perspective of the learning technology industry itself. So what do you see as some of the top challenges facing the industry in 2013, and then some of the top opportunities for the industry in 2013?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, so some of the challenges that we see are ones that have existed for a long time, and I alluded to one or two of them previously. I think the biggest one, which is always going to be an issue, is the one that I mentioned before, and that's about really assessing whether or not these things work. And how can we best assess whether or not these things work? So while it's just as important to innovate in terms of our technologies and things that we believe will improve education, it's equally important to innovate in terms of how we measure these things and deriving better and more accurate forms of measurement, if that's even possible, because they are needed to support the continuing improvement in terms of how we actually build these technologies that support learning. So as I say, this isn't a new problem. This is something that pre-existed technology, but it's something that I think the advent of learning technologies has really brought to the forefront, because what we're doing is we're proposing, and we have proposed for the last 15 years, a lot of changes which make a lot of people very uncomfortable because it's been so static for so long, as I had also mentioned previously. And so when you put in the face of all these people who are happy with the way things work, new ways of doing things, it's very important that you have the backup so that you can unequivocally say, yes, you know, this really does make a difference. It makes a positive difference. So it's worth investigating. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to do it, but it's certainly worth looking at. We're not risking anything too large by doing that. So I think there are a number of challenges, but I think most of them are centered around that. Most of them are centered around just being confident and having a way to measure all these new ideas that we have to see if and how they work. And I think that's for me is the central challenge that we have.
Now, even taking this whole concept even broader, perhaps to the entire ICT industry, or you may just want to focus again on learning technologies, what do you see as some of the major computing areas or specialties or domains having the highest growth rates, and why?
Yeah, I'll probably stick to e-learning because it's something I can talk a little bit more about. I can talk about more personally than I guess ICT as a whole. You know, some of the really interesting things that are going on right now are the ones that I suspect will have the highest growth rate. I mean, you mentioned in the word association game before MOOCs, and I think that's an emerging thing which we have to watch because, again, the potential to educate millions just, you know, suddenly is now at our fingertips. And we have to figure out how we can do it, and we have to figure out how we can best do it. So they're getting a lot of attention right now, and I think that attention is deserved. I think one important aspect, though, that isn't getting it quite as much attention, but I think it works very well with MOOCs and certainly with the original idea of MOOCs, are social learning systems. It's incredibly important to understand that, you know, one way of disseminating knowledge is certainly from, you know, the old sage on the stage kind of thing. One person creating, not knowledge, but, you know, creating a learning module, let's say, and giving it to everybody, a very one way. But I think we've learned in the past, and I think we're learning more and more now, that there's so much that we can do in social learning systems by basically enabling informal learning, by allowing people who have a common learning goal to get together and removing the barriers between them that inhibit communication, that inhibit sharing, and that really inhibit teaching one another. Because in a peer learning environment, there no two people are created equal. I mean, chances are somebody in that environment wants to know something. There is somebody else in that environment that already knows it. And so it's certainly something I've been involved in in the last little while, is creating technologies that enable discovery, that basically try to track what people are doing in a learning environment, track the connections between them and other people, track the connections between them and content, and then making those connections available to new learners in order to facilitate discovery for them. So social learning systems, I think, are exceedingly important, and I think they play very well with the desire to educate the world, because it's, I mean, very much like, you know, we've learned so much from systems like Facebook and whatnot, how to establish relationships and how to connect people on kind of a social plane. We can apply these things to learning, and they're infinitely scalable because every learner brings teaching to the equation as well. It's not as though the ratio I can handle as a faculty member is 1 to 200 or whatever. Now, for every new learner that comes, there's a new teacher there as well. And I think the potential is limitless. So it's an area that I'm very interested in as well. I think another thing that we have to watch very carefully, because I think it has wonderful potential, is the whole notion of personalized and adaptive learning. And building technologies that investigate the learner as much as the learner is investigating the content, and learn something about the learner, either explicitly by asking them questions or by giving them a test, or implicitly by watching the content that they go to and looking at click patterns and that kind of thing, and then saying, now we know something about this learner, let's use heuristics to provide to them the kind of learning experience that makes sense for them. Because just as every learner brings something to the table, every learner is created very differently. I mean, we used to teach to this notion of the typical student. Well, I've got news for you. There is no such thing as the typical student. That's just one student who kind of sits in the middle of, the broad range of students. And so when we teach to the typical student, it means we're teaching to nobody, or maybe to one person. Personalized and adaptive learning allow us to custom make a learning experience for every learner. And now these systems are fairly crude still to begin with, no doubt, but I think over time, as we get better and better at understanding our learners and using metrics and analyzing metrics in order to understand them better and better, it allows us to deliver these automatically, technologically driven, customized learning experiences to them, which really makes sense for them and help them learn.
Murray, you are considered one of the most successful innovators in this country, and you, in essence, created an entire industry a number of years ago, especially in the minds of many, many people around the world. So based on that experience, what do you think in terms of, you know, the kinds of policies that we need to foster innovation?
You know, that's I like that question. You know, what do we need to foster innovation? And you know, you talked about policies, and I think that's an important part of it. But I also think we have to be a little bit careful about how we do this. I mean, I take the man. I mean, we talked about the Manning Awards a little bit, and I take that as a very good model for fostering innovation and an innovative culture. You know, it's interesting. I learned a long time ago with WebCT that I think one of the reasons that we were successful is because we didn't require anybody to change the way they taught. And that was a very early and a very profound lesson, because I saw competitors come and go, arguably very good competitors who had very good systems, but that required the people using those systems to change. So they you know, it was forced in a sense. If you want to use this, this is how you have to teach. The approach that we took, again, not through intelligence or by design, just really because it seemed right at the time more than anything else, was that we provided a set of tools to people, and that's why it was called, in fact, Web Course Tool, that people could keep in their toolbox and pick and choose from as they felt appropriate. And we tried to make it very hard, we tried very hard, rather, to make it so that there was no requirement to change the way you taught, but that it supported the way you currently teach, and that there were these other tools there that should you decide to experiment, and I think that's the key, that the path to that experimentation is available to you right at your fingertips. There's no friction. There's no difficulty in going down that path. And so I think in terms of fostering innovation, I think that's what's really important. We can't mandate innovation. There's no way to do that. We can grease the wheels. We can reduce the friction. We can make experimentation available to people in whatever discipline they're working in and make it available right at their fingertips, because I think it's a natural human desire, frankly, to innovate, and it's just the momentum that we have, you know, taking us away from innovation that often causes what otherwise would be very innovative people to not be able to innovate. So really, again, for me, it's about putting the message of innovation front and center to make people aware of innovation stories that have occurred so that they can relate to them personally and understand that person did it. Why can't I do that? You know? And then to make facilities to make, certainly at universities and whatnot, but which are naturally innovative places, but to try to spread that kind of culture more broadly in society through government, through programs, all these kinds of things. I mean, we have the SHRED program, which you might argue certainly is, well, you would argue is there to foster innovation. You might argue that it's successful or not. I think it's by and large a very good program. But, you know, those kinds of things really help in terms of improving the innovative culture in Canada. And I think that's really what it's about, getting the word out, making sure people relate to it personally to understand I can do that, and then giving them the means, putting it at their fingertips so that it's a very small step to do a small bit of innovation. And to understand also that innovation doesn't have to be one huge success somewhere. It's that little bit of experiment that I can do as a teacher in my grade 7 math class to learn something which nobody else knows, right? I mean, why can't I change the way I teach just a little bit and experiment that way? We have to be willing to do that, and we have to be willing to fail, and our administrators have to be willing to support that kind of thing. I think it's very important.
Murray, you have this amazing background as a very, very successful entrepreneur, and you're highly respected throughout the country and, in fact, around the world because of your entrepreneurship. So we want to mine some of that experience. What are your top best practices for startups?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that, because it's been a lot of fun doing startups, and there's so much that I think I learned, which I wish I knew at the beginning. And you know, a lot of people talk about things like, well, have a business plan. That was the first thing I was told when I started my first company. I thought, well, I better go make a business plan. It wasn't that useful to me, to be perfectly honest. And maybe it's a great idea. I'm not knocking it at all. But the things that I found to be personally very useful were quite a bit different. Passion, absolutely. And you'll hear that from everybody. Passion is critical to success. In the Manning Awards, all the various innovations that I've seen awarded, without exception, passion is the overriding common factor between all of them, because it's a case that, you know, there's no direct line from idea to major success. In between those two points, there are huge hills and huge valleys, it's amazing, because I remember I used to describe to my wife, working at the university is a constantly high level of enjoyment, but it's a pretty flat line, but working in industry, especially at startups, are these huge highs and then these huge, terrible lows and then these huge highs again because somebody's unhappy with you and you're at the bottom and then somebody loves your software and it's at the top. So you have to have the passion to take you through these terrible valleys, I guess I would say. That's number one. Knowledge is really important too. It's really nice because having a background with WebCT and whatnot, I get a lot of people, almost weekly, I would say, that come for coffee and just share individuals, just who want to come and share their ideas for the startup they're currently working on and just, chat about it a little bit. It's interesting because the ones that seem to end up with the most success, and this has certainly been an issue for me, is having knowledge in the area that you're working on. I mean, a lot of people will have an idea completely outside their domain and say, I think there needs to be this great new device, and I'll ask, well, what do you know about that? And, well, nothing, but I'll learn about it. Well, the problem is, if there really does need to be this great new device, somebody who already understands that field is much better equipped to judge whether or not there needs to be that device and much better equipped to actually implement that thing. I think it's exceedingly important to try to get as much background in whatever discipline you want to innovate in as possible. And how do you do that? Well, go work somewhere. I mean, you could come right out of high school or right out of university and have a startup, but I think you're much more likely to be successful if you're willing to take the time and work your way through the ranks. If you're willing to take the time to truly understand what the pain points are in that industry that you're working in and how the existing practices have failed to solve those pain points. So deep knowledge of an area, very, very important. And that knowledge is going to give you credibility as well, because at some point you're going to want to raise money or do these kinds of things. Nobody's going to give you money unless they think you know what you're talking about. And the only way to know what you're talking about is to have a proven track record of working in that industry or working in that discipline. Mentors have been very, very important to me as well. And I don't just mean one, I mean multiple mentors. We talked about Maria and how she's been critical, really, to me in the work that I've done. Another one that I had is, his name is David Koh, a wonderful person, totally different discipline. He was leader of a very large dairy company, which he multiplied roughly 10 times over his tenure there. And I was a member of a president's group where he was the mentor. And, you know, just one little thing, the very first and biggest thing I think he drove home for me, it's a saying he gave us over and over again, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. Well, simple and obvious, but you know, the depth of the meaning of that really only was made clear to me through my interactions with him and you know, what does that really mean and how does that really apply in business? Very, very important to have mentors. And now that I'm on the topic of that president's group, the peers, the other presidents that were in that group, there were 10 of us, fantastic people. There isn't a single person there that I didn't learn a tremendous amount from that I applied to business. I learned something from each of those that I was able to apply to my business. So having a peer group that you meet with is very important, and I especially liked it too, because when you have a company, whether it's a small company or a large company, you have a lot of people around, but there are certain topics that are, you really don't have anybody to talk about with. People who understand, you know, the position that you're in and the decisions you have to make and whatnot. And only people in the same position can really help inform some of those decisions. And so having this peer group that you meet with, very important to me. Another one that was certainly a big aspect was not being afraid to deviate from the plan that you have at hand. I mean, I've done that a number of times, but it's the case that the benefit of the startup is that you can actually be very nimble and very agile, and you can change plans fairly quickly, and you don't want to do that unnecessarily, for sure. But when you do hit a wall or you see a better idea, it's okay to do that. And some people are very resistant to doing that. It's happened to me a number of times. I've been very lucky because most of those times it's been the case that I've been able to repurpose whatever it is that I've been doing to attack this different problem. I didn't have to start from scratch, but it's important. And the last one for me, I think that's been very important, is being able to involve the people that you care about. Assuming that you have a wife or if you have kids, they have to be involved. Certainly for me, it was the case that they have to be involved. I'd mentioned before that I traveled so much in early WebCT days. I did over 200,000 qualifying miles a year. And for people that travel, you know that's a lot. And what it really meant was, you know, on Sunday I would leave for Madrid, I'd be back Wednesday afternoon, and then on Thursday morning I'd leave for Boston, and I'd be back Saturday morning, kind of thing. I always tried very hard to be home on the weekends, but I was away pretty much all week, all the time, two major trips a week. If I didn't have the support of my wife, I'd either be divorced or I wouldn't have a family anymore. I guess those are the same things. I'd either be divorced or wouldn't have a business anymore. we made very conscious decisions about how much effort this was going to take, how long we would give it, because we had to have an end in sight, and her involvement in it. Ultimately, I'd mentioned before, my wife's a mathematician and an architect, and now a painter, but she took a hiatus, and she worked in accounting in WebCT in its early days, and that gave her a hands-on view of what I was doing and why I felt it was important, and she could make decisions with me in an informed way. So those things were really, really all important, very, very important.
Murray, that's a great series of tips to provide and lessons from all of the experiences you've had. It's interesting, though, you're talking about business plans and the fact that you didn't find them to be a sort of the value that a lot of people put on it.
Yeah, and you know, I don't, I'm certainly not trying to knock the idea of a business plan, because, you know, their goal, their overall goal is to make sure that you have an idea of what you're trying to achieve and how you want to achieve it. And I think that's important. But when I started in business, it was presented to me as the overriding, number one, all-encompassing thing that you had to do, almost to the exclusion of these other things, which I found to be much, much more important. And even people who tell you of the importance of business plans will tell you that you're going to deviate from them. And it's not as though I don't get that. I do get that. But the deviation was so rapid and so quick, and I learned so much that the moment I wrote the plan, it wasn't that effective for me anymore. And maybe, again, somebody who's a big proponent of business plans would say, well, that's the point. You know, it's not supposed to be effective the minute after you write it. It's supposed to help you form your thoughts. And to that degree, I absolutely get it. But I don't think it needs to be done in quite the same formal way. I mean, we wrote like a 100-page business plan. We spent a lot of time doing it, and it was developed for an external audience. And I don't think it provided the value that these other things did. I think I could have done the same thing with 10 pages to crystallize the thoughts that I had at the time, recognizing the plan was going to be a living document and change. And that's, in fact, what I ended up doing, and it worked out very, very well. So I'll be cautious in what I say about this, because I'm not trying to say a business plan is a bad idea or is not useful. Both are wrong. A business plan is a good idea and is useful. Just ensure that as people give advice about business plans to you people who are considering startups, that you don't take it as the all-encompassing gospel. And there are these other things that I think contribute more to success. Have your plan. Know what you want to do. Understand the consequences of what you do and how you want to exit and all. How are you going to fund it? You need to think about these things, because you're going to find out that they're actually very important. But documenting it in a 100-page document isn't that important until you possibly want to go raise money.
And I kind of smile because you ended on the note of raising money, and I guess that leads to this question. You know, what are the secrets to fundraising?
Secrets to fundraising. So I've been involved in a number of fundraisers. So the various companies I've done have been from have all had kind of different contexts. WebCT initially started as a grant-funded project, and we never raised any money until we started to grow, and then we raised that very large growth spurt after we combined with ULT, and then together we raised like $125 million. It was a big raise done out of the U.S. Silicon Chalk, we raised locally $4 million. My company right now, I'm funding myself. And there are real benefits to me. I wanted to try each way, and there are real benefits and drawbacks to both ways. But raising money is an interesting and difficult process sometimes, and it's very time consuming. So I guess my first bit of advice would be to realize that it's almost a full-time job, especially if you want to raise money from VCs. You need somebody who's out there producing the documents, making the story, connecting, all that kind of stuff. It is almost a full-time job. The secret to success, well, first of all, a past success really helps. And obviously that's not too helpful for most people, because, you know, once you have a past success, sure, it's a lot easier to raise money for your next one. So how do you get to the past success? And it's all the things that I talked about before. It's passion and knowledge and having mentors and peers and, you know, involving your family, all these kinds of things. That's how you get your first success. Maybe it's a little bit more modest. Once you have that, it's much easier to raise money. If you don't have that, those same things will give investors confidence in you. Again, having deep knowledge about what it is, the domain that you're working in, right? And when I say a past success, it doesn't have to be a past business success necessarily, although that's very valuable if you have it. Past success in your discipline, whatever that is, would give you the credibility. Because remember, and probably this is the most important lesson I've learned about raising money, remember, VCs are people too. Despite what many like to say about them, VCs are real people, and they're humans, and they have many of the same considerations that you have. And they have jobs, by the way, and their job is to be successful at giving money out. And success for them is measured by whether or not you're going to send more money back than they sent to you in the first place. And so put yourself in their position and understand what it is that they need from you. They need confidence in you. They need to know that you know what you're talking about. They need to know that you're a reasonable person. A VC once said to me, and I think it's very true, 20% of what we consider is the idea, the thing, you know, the technology or the startup it is that we're investing in. 80% is you. We're investing in you because we realize things are going to change. If we have confidence in you, then we know that as you get through these trials and tribulations, you're still going to be there. You're still going to be trying. All these kinds of things that will ultimately, hopefully, give them a return on their investment. And so, as I say, when you remember that they're people, not just these evil things that are there to destroy your life and ruin your business and all that kind of thing, which isn't true, by the way. I have had nothing but the best experience with the VCs that we've worked with, both in companies that have succeeded and in companies that have failed. They've been there enabling the creation of a company which otherwise couldn't have existed. So if you need money, and if you need the kind of money that you can only get from a VC, go to a VC. If you can do it without money, more power to you. Don't raise money if you don't need to. That's one of the best pieces of advice that I can give you. If you need to raise a small amount of money, sure, do it from family and friends. Don't mortgage your house. But find the appropriate money, or none if at all possible, other than your own. But if you do need to raise that big pot of money, remember, VCs are people too.
It's interesting when you're talking about the sort of fundraising and some of the tips that you're providing. Now, Murray, you've had to make a pitch in front of investors. Do you find that it's a 15-minute sort of talk, or is it 5 minutes, or is it an hour, or, do you find that you've got to get it in quick and fast, or you lose their interest? I mean, do you have any tips on the actual presentation process itself?
Everything you just said is completely correct. It's 30 seconds, it's 5 minutes, it's 15 minutes, it's an hour, it's getting everything in quickly. It's all of those things at the various stages, right? So as you go through the process with VCs, they get more and more engaged. You're presenting to larger and larger audiences. You're providing more and more detail. The mistake that I am always accused of making, and rightfully accused, is trying to put too much information into a short amount of time. Because as I'm creating this, there's so much stuff in my head that I think is critical that they understand right away. And so I talk fast, as I'm doing now, because I'm always a fast talker and I can even talk faster than this. And so I'm packing information into a short time. Not a great idea. It's hard for me to avoid, but it's not a great idea. Just as it's important to make sure they understand things, it's important to prioritize and figure out what it is you really need them to understand and focus on those at the right time. It's very much all about timing. It's interesting. It's like most endeavors. It's like writing a novel or writing an article in a magazine or whatever. You want to engage them in steps. Your job, the first time you meet them, isn't to sell them on an investment. It's to get them to be interested enough to ask you to come and see them at their office. When you come and see them at their office, your job there isn't to get the money. It's to get them to be interested enough to ask you back to present to the partners. Your job, and so on. So, you get what I'm trying to say. So it's important to understand the goal at hand. The goal at hand from the beginning is not to raise money. It's to get that invitation and then so on. So understand your goals. Understand what it is that you need to be able to tell them in order to achieve that immediate goal, and then work on that and talk appropriately.
You chaired the Manning Awards here in BC, and you attend the national conferences for the Manning Awards as chair for the BC chapter. In addition, you have a very successful career of innovation, and you've known worldwide for that. So what do you feel are the best qualities that make for a successful innovator?
Really, I think the qualities stem from a lot of the things that are important for startups. Really, you need to care. And I mentioned before, seeing all these people who have won the Manning Awards over the years, people like from Rick Hansen to the developer of the V chip and others, these people cared about something deeply. And that's what drives innovation. I think that's the biggest thing that drives innovation. And then the rest of that are just the things that I talked about before that create success. understanding, knowledge, support, mentors, peers, the ability to change plans when you need to. But really it's most innovators that I see are working in an area, they see a problem and they discover that, hey, I have an idea on how I can fix that problem. And to me, that's one of the biggest drivers of innovation. So if you want to be an innovator, go work somewhere. Go work somewhere that you really care about, in a field that you really care about. If you want to be a veterinarian, be a veterinarian. If you want to be an accountant, be an accountant. You're invariably going to find things that just don't work. Keep your eyes open and then go home and think about it for a little bit, and you'll be surprised at how quickly you become an innovator yourself.
With the advent of the internet, we are surrounded with so much noise, so much information. I mean, how do you sort out what's good and what's bad? In other words, what kind of resources do you use to get your information?
You know, the resources that I use to get my information, really, many of them are social resources, although I'm not a very big Facebook user. Interestingly, I'm really not a Twitter user at all. but I do tend to use LinkedIn because it's very targeted for me, and I know Facebook can be this way too, but it's very targeted for me to the industry that I'm working in. It just so happens to be right now that the maritime industry has much more of a presence, it seems, on LinkedIn than it does on Facebook. So that's a fairly big resource for me in terms of connecting with other people. But speaking more broadly of resources, you know, not just resources of information, but tools and things like that, I happen to actually be a fairly big Google Docs user because a lot of the stuff that I do is collaborative. And Google Docs I find to be a very good collaborative platform, obviously for things like editing and sharing and whatnot. So I guess those are the biggest two, if I had to name two.
We've touched on some of this already, but if you were to kind of spotlight the areas of controversy in the areas that you work in, what would they be?
Yeah, you know, the biggest area of controversy for learning technologies has been the one that started in day one and still exists, and that's do these things work? And while I've talked a little bit already about the insights that we're gaining into the answer to that question, and I think those insights are great, we have a long way to go. Now, we've come a long way. I mean, I remember, I don't know if you remember the name David Noble, you probably don't, e-learning people will. He was a fellow, I think, from U of T, and, you know, he was a very outspoken critic of e-learning at all. I mean, he wrote paper after paper about how it's a really bad idea to use e-learning and how it was not useful in terms of its effectiveness and how it put universities in bed with corporations and all these kinds of things. You know, so we've come a long way since that because people have gained an understanding. But the biggest area of controversy still remains, do these things work? And everybody understands the financial implications now quite well. Everybody understands the access issues very well. Everybody understands much better now the access to technology, which was an impediment before. That's being alleviated to a large degree. But the biggest one is educationally. Can we say unequivocally that people learn just as well or better using these technologies as they do in the face-to-face model? And that will be the controversy, I think, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Now, we've explored a lot of topic areas, and we're down to our last three questions, and these are very broad in terms of what we're going to discuss. And the first question is about computing. You know, it's been around for, what, since the 30s, 40s, sort of in a recognizable sense. And, you know, there's other professions like accounting, medicine, and law. And those professions have things like demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, recognized credentials. Now, do you think computing should be recognized as a profession on par with those others with recognized credentials, or even if it's unlicensed credentials?
Yeah, you know, I think there are definite benefits to that. I mean, in a nutshell, I think the answer is yes. And I think what people have to realize, I mean, you know, as computing people, we're very close to engineers. I guess that would be the closest similar profession, which, as you know, is a highly regulated profession. And there's a reason that it's highly regulated, and the reason is because engineers build things that, if they don't work very well, can kill people. Well, it turns out that, you know, more and more computing is a part of basically everything that happens in the world. And there are safety critical system after safety critical system, where it's very important that we get these things right, because they will kill people if there is sometimes a software error and we don't accommodate for that software error. We know there are always going to be errors. It's more about minimizing them and accommodating for them than preventing them. But even where they're not safety critical systems, because you could argue that's a fairly small part, but growing, I would argue, a part of what computing applies to, these are more and more computing is mission critical. I mean, you know, one of the things that surprised me the most back in early WebCT days was I was at a customer, I'm just trying to remember who it was, I think it was in the University of Georgia system, but anyway, they were saying, their head of kind of computing technology there, and learning technology rather, was saying to me that they had recently done a disaster recovery planning session on campus, and they had determined that WebCT was their second most mission critical resource on campus. And I asked what the most critical one was, and he said payroll. But that to me was profound. It said to me, oh my goodness, you know, the stuff that we're doing, and we're trying to do our best at it, is considered mission critical to this organization of 40,000 students or whatever it was a large university. Well, if we're building things that is mission critical or potentially life critical to the world at large, you know, shouldn't we apply a little bit more discipline to what we do, I guess is the question. And I think the answer is yes. I think we have to do it very carefully because, you know, the accreditation bodies and all these kinds of things have a negative side as well. I think sometimes they can stifle innovation if they're not done well. They can be draconian in terms of and very difficult to change. And they often it's difficult for them to adapt change. And they move very slowly. But I think we have to pay attention to all those things. But as long as we do it right, yes, I think it's a very good idea.
Murray, due to your really remarkable history of success, you are a legend in the industry and known worldwide. And in fact, as you indicated earlier, you've been invited to the Annenberg retreat at Sunnylands to work on some really, really fundamental issues. And it's because you're famous and you're knowledgeable and because you're successful and you've made a lot of contributions. Because of that, you have traveled widely, you worked throughout the world, you were invited to speak at conferences. Is there anything sort of that strikes you from a story standpoint that you want to share? Maybe something amusing, amazing, surprising or unexpected?
You know, there have been a lot of unexpected things, not too many amusing ones, but a lot of unexpected ones. I've touched on a couple of them, you know, hearing first that these technologies were mission critical to people. I mean, that was remarkable to me. Being a part of this community that really spanned the globe, but that was brought together by a common desire to improve the world, I think was just a wonderful thing that came to me over time. And getting to meet so many interesting, wonderful people. I remember I was down, I was in Arkansas once, and sometimes people do things differently in Arkansas, and they were choosing a learning management system. It was a consortium of 20 colleges. And what they decided to do was have me and a fellow from IBM, they had Lotus Learning Space, I think it was called, and two others who I can't remember, each present for an hour. Then the 100 people in the audience were to go away, make a decision, and then they lined us up at the front of the room to announce the winner. It was like a beauty pageant. It was very weird. I was very fortunate because we actually ended up winning that beauty pageant, so I felt bad for the others. But when they announced it, a lady at the back said, and I can't do a southern accent, and I happened to tell these people that I was on my way to Alabama the week after, and she stood up and said, "We're choosing you, but my advice for you is when you go to Alabama, slow down and say y'all every once in a while, because you're not going to do well there otherwise." And so to me, this was, I mean, they didn't think it was funny. I think she was being very serious. For me, I couldn't stop laughing. But it really taught me about, you know, different people and the different things they care about. And as different as we are, we can be united in a common desire to hopefully improve the world.
That's a really good story. It made me laugh. I'm smiling right now. Now, we're down to our final question, and it's kind of an open-ended question in the sense that I sort of reverse it, and I'm saying that if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
You know, I think you did a great job, because so much about this for me is about making sure that people understand that if you want to, you can do something interesting in the world. And I think that the biggest thing, the biggest takeaway that I'd like to make sure people understand, that I believe anyway, is that making a small difference is important. I think it's important to make a difference in whatever you do, and everybody has the capacity to do it, whatever area they happen to be working in. And my point is, it doesn't have to be a big difference. It doesn't have to be something that people are going to recognize or is going to affect a large number of people or anything like that. It can be a difference in the class that you teach, or in a mentoring relationship you have with an individual. And we see examples like that, like with Maria and whatnot. So the question would be, you know, what's the biggest takeaway that I've learned, I guess? And I think you kind of asked that in many different ways already. But if I had to put it in one place, I would say, you know, make one small difference in any way that you can, and you've made, you know, you leave the world a slightly better place than the way you found it. And it doesn't have to be in the way that everybody tells you. Maybe you're not the best recycler in the world. Well, you should try to change that, absolutely. But, you know, maybe you have this great relationship with this one student, or with this one coworker, or whatever, and they need something that you can give them. Well, do that. It's easy, and it improves the world.
You know, that's a great tip or lesson to sort of share with the audience about doing some incremental improvement or being agile in your thinking, perhaps, and maybe tied into the neuroplasticity that's in all of us, which means that we can grow and you can enable the growth of others. So thank you for sharing that. And I know, Maria, it's been, you know, your schedule is really, really demanding, and yet you've taken the time to share so many insights with the audience, and we're indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. So thank you for taking the time to share experiences today.
Thank you, Stephen. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for taking the time and for having this venue.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Murray Goldberg, award-winning, international, top, innovating ICT serial entrepreneur.